Borders contain nations, act as fault lines, but are also meeting points where different cultures, people, and ideologies come into contact. Nowhere has been this more visible, more painful, and more politically charged than the island of Ireland. In recent years, cross-border tensions have flared again, fueled by Brexit and questions of sovereignty. But it's also a powerful example in recent history of how conflict can be transformed into cooperation and peace. The Good Friday Belfast Agreement was signed in 1998, and I can remember how momentous the occasion was. It didn't just bring an end to decades of violence in Northern Ireland, it created a model for peace rooted in power sharing, respect, and complex, carefully negotiated compromises, balancing the gains and the losses. What can we learn from the agreement, and can those lessons be applied to global conflicts? To answer all this, I'm joined by Professor Katie Heywood. She's one of the UK's leading voices on Brexit, the Irish border, and cross-border tension and transformation. A political sociologist at Queen's University Belfast and co-director of the Centre for International Borders Research, her work bridges politics and the everyday experience of life on the border. Amazing stuff. I'm looking forward to this. We society, how does the we society kind of intersect with your preoccupation about borders and border cultures?
It's a good question, Will, and I should say thank you very much for having me on. It's a great privilege to be here. I mean, the immediate thing that strikes me about the we society notion, and I understand it's intended to contrast with that of me society, perhaps, but is that immediately it provokes senses of insiders, outsiders, right? So oftentimes when we're thinking about borders, nations, it's about the us and them. And when people refer to we, particularly politicians, of course, they're wanting to stimulate some sense of distinction. And my natural instinct is to be wary of that. And we've seen, obviously, that was very much demonstrated in Brexit, but a very much live issue again today in a lot of the discourses that exist around borders and contemporary border management.
I mean, the prism through which you look at the Northern Ireland conflict and the tensions now seems less between, you know, the great kind of religious kind of groupings, you know, nationalism and unionism. But your prism is the border. And it's a kind of very particular way of actually thinking about a country or an economic and political problem. How does looking at it through that prism change what you see?
So I should say I look at it that way because that's the way that the two governments looked at it. You mentioned the Good Friday Belfast Agreement. They decided to approach the conflict in Northern Ireland as being primarily about national identities and therefore about the border, because the contention between Irish nationalism, British unionism, is around whether the border should exist on the island of Ireland. So the legitimacy of that or otherwise. And they approached it that way because it gave them legitimacy to negotiate and to facilitate the negotiations between the parties in Northern Ireland. On one hand, there's a positive legacy because we could have institutions and strands that enable power sharing between these two communities. We have North-South institutions on the island of Ireland, we have British-Irish institutions. So that's very helpful in managing a complex problem. The negative side, one of the negative sides of that legacy is you put the border right there continually in politics in Northern Ireland. So unionism and nationalism continues to be the most important political identities. And those who put themselves as being the spokespersons for unionism or nationalism have a very particular privileged place. 27 years on from the Good Friday Belfast Agreement, it is worth saying, is that still the best way of understanding political needs and interests in Northern Ireland, or is there a need to look at it a different way? And unfortunately, and I think it is unfortunate, Brexit is actually, and the whole process of Brexit has actually given a certain logic to keeping the border right there as the issue in Northern Ireland politics, the contentious point.
We will go into that, but just I want to pick up something that you said. There are other ways of looking at this. What other ways could those be?
So one obvious other way that many people try to put forward is, of course, in relation to class and the economy. one thing is very clear. Those areas that were most deeply affected by the conflict in terms of victims and losses and violence were areas of multiple deprivation. They continue to be the areas where you see strongest paramilitary influence and where you see strongest votes in many cases for the two parties that claim to be the spokespersons for strong nationalism and strong unionism. So looking at the conflict in a different way, if you'd have looked at it in terms of the economic, and obviously left-wing activists did do this, many sociologists looked at it in this way too, but it didn't gain traction as a sense that this is caused by inequality. Another way of looking at it, of course, is a colonial legacy, that the fallout from British colonialism and the destructive impact that that's had. And others look at it primarily through a religious prism, of course, that the lasting differences between Catholicism and Protestantism in Northern Ireland therefore continue to play out in cultural differences.
Except religion is on the wane. Although, is it in the Republic, and is it in Northern Ireland?
Well, very much so in the Republic of Ireland. So even though you still have, well, people talk about cultural Catholicism, it's still definitely there.
It's still real, isn't it?
It is real, but in terms of political impact, it has far less clout than it did. And of course, you see that in the major social transformations in Ireland, including in relation to equal marriage, for example. In Northern Ireland, we have seen a rise in those saying they are no religion and born into families with no religion, but they're still very much a minority. And everybody uses this rather hackneyed example of the impact of religion still, but only 5% of secondary schools are integrated in Northern Ireland, post-primary schools. So about 7% of kids, if you include primary schools, go to integrated schools.
So Brexit has added to the flames because it has suddenly made the border and border politics and all that the border stands for more real in Northern Irish politics and economics.
It certainly brought it right back to the fore. And I wouldn't say it was just because of the difference of opinion that unionists largely, nationalists largely had about the European Union and about membership of it.
Nor broadly, nationalists were for it, and
yes,
and broadly, unionists were against it. I mean, broadly, yes. I mean, there's not.
Yes, and we did see that in the voting on the 2016 referendum.
How did Northern Ireland vote then?
So it voted 56% to remain. If you look at a map of the constituencies who voted to remain, all of those along the Irish border voted predominantly to remain. Those further away voted to leave. And interestingly, I find this interesting anyway, in the 2017 general election, do you remember that snap election that Theresa May called? That was a stark election for Northern Ireland because of all our 18 constituencies returned, only one, which was an independent, didn't vote either DUP or Sinn Féin. So when you look at the map of how people voted in Brexit, pretty much the constituencies that voted to leave are DUP, by 2017, and those that voted to remain Sinn Féin. Now, that's changed in the election since, but that was just a really good example of the connection between Brexit and the fallout from that, and then the sort of move towards polarised politics once more.
How would Northern Ireland vote now?
I think there were various dynamics around why people chose to vote the way they did. There was a low turnout in Northern Ireland, relatively speaking. I think you'd be pretty sure of having at least two-thirds or maybe higher voting to remain now, I would imagine. Partly because of the younger generation and partly too because of all of the fallout from Brexit and the disruptive effect that that's had.
Now let's just talk about border and Brexit and actually what it obviously means for Northern Ireland, but also other avenues, really, thinking about the border. I'm an economist, political economist, and now, I note that actually being in the EU single market and the British single market is good news, basically, for trade. And actually, absent some of the political tensions, and you'd expect Northern Ireland to do quite well. And actually, it is doing fairly well. I mean, it had a long history of being the least performing economic region, you know, the British regional kind of geography. That's not true now. And there must be a constituency in Northern Ireland who see that and who kind of think that's bloody good. And yet, it remains even more contentious, doesn't it? I mean, just unpack that for listeners.
Yes. As I regularly complete polling with my colleague David Finnemore on opinion in Northern Ireland regarding the Windsor framework. So essentially, as part of the UK-EU withdrawal agreement, there was a special arrangement for Northern Ireland to keep the Irish border open. It is a strange beast because it keeps Northern Ireland in the UK internal market, in the UK customs territory, but de facto, it is part of the EU single market for goods and de facto part of the Union customs. So as you say, Northern Ireland still is able to trade across the Irish border with its neighbour and into the rest of the EU without any of the restrictions that businesses based in Great Britain have.
Yeah, a lorry can rumble down to Dublin or Cork docks and ship stuff straight into France and Northern Europe, yeah?
Yes.
And does.
Yes, it does. I think practically speaking, they thought it's going to be much easier to impose checks and controls on goods coming across maybe half a dozen entry points into Northern Ireland than across the Irish land border, which has 208 crossing points. So it was a pragmatic decision apart from anything else. However, you're talking about borders here. So of course, it's going to be highly contentious. And in the minds of unionists, but others, there was a sense that maybe the British government decided to keep the Irish land border open with the Republic of Ireland, but close, you know, tighten the border that connects Northern Ireland to the rest of the UK. So in this sense, it was a big win for nationalism. And what we saw in surveys in Northern Ireland after that point, after the protocol was recognised, was increasingly unionist and others thought Brexit makes United Ireland more likely. So for them, this decision by the British government, which centred on what they were going to do about the border, was a huge loss and a huge source of insecurity. There were many protests. We had a shutdown of the Assembly and the Executive. There were threats of violence, loyalist unionists objecting to the protocol. There was threats, of course, by the British government to break international law and ignore the protocol. So it was a big, big chaotic mess. And eventually, the UK and the EU did negotiate, as you say, with Rishi Sunak, and they called it the Windsor Framework. So basically, they adjusted this protocol to temper down some of its most egregious elements with respect to what it required of goods entering Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK. And as you'd imagine, you can guess for the name Windsor Framework, they literally painted it red, white and blue to try and reassure the unionists.
Another example of where the kind of the Windsor family and the kind of regality kind of helps the British state along.
Like,
giving an invitation to Donald Trump, you know.
It's
an astonishing kind of thing in a democratic, largely Republican world that kings matter.
Yes.
And the symbolism of kingship matters, you know, queenship.
Yes, they went through a lot of trouble to make it as close to Windsor as possible. And Ursula von der Leyen travelling over to make the announcement there. You know, even as social scientists, we were told, do not refer to it anymore as a protocol. Even though legally that was it has to be the Windsor framework. So they went to great trouble in this. And certainly amongst softer unionists, they I don't want to say bought it because it sounds like they were being sold something, but they did think this is reassuring. We have been heard by the British government on this. The EU has moved. That's good. Didn't convince the harder unionists, the DUP. They stayed out of power sharing until last year when they had a very unusual agreement from the British government. What happened was the DUP were able to say, we're going back into power sharing, but we do so still objecting to these arrangements for Northern Ireland. So we will continue to protest at the existence of the Windsor framework because fundamentally there's been this huge breach of trust between unionism and the British government. And it has been very much about what the British government has decided to do about its borders.
But you come to this again through the prism of the border. Now, of course, management of the border and the way it's done refracts into Northern Irish politics, that's obvious. But again, it's rather curious the way a border defines, you know, political arguments. I mean, it defines economic argument. We all know that borders matter, that you get your passport out and all the rest. And we all know that, you know, there are different kind of legal regimes the other side of the border. But it's not the kind of be all and end all. Is it different in Northern Ireland? What lessons do you draw from what you observe in Northern Ireland for other contested borders? I mean, as a social scientist, what's drawing you into this kind of debate?
So it's interesting that you think, now, I am biased, obviously, but it's interesting that you think borders don't really matter.
Of course they matter. But if you think about kind of debates in the UK outside Northern Ireland, you know, you talk about child poverty, or you talk about the criminal justice system, or you talk about innovation, or, you know, there's a lot of other things. The national conversation is quite kind of variegated. It isn't as dominated by the one thing.
Maybe so. But if you think about it, the UK, its international standing, its whole constitution has been completely overhauled by the romanticism of a notion of taking back control of our borders.
Yeah, that's true.
But, you know, everybody responded to that in a certain way, and it continues to be something that people are moved by. I think in Northern Ireland, you can't be that way. The state itself is contested.
Yep.
Even, and you can't be secure even if you're a unionist. In fact, you're probably least secure if you're a unionist, because of this sense of, do we really matter? So at the same time as appreciating what happened with the Good Friday Belfast Agreement and all that it achieved, this model has gone around the world. How you manage the way out of conflicts, including talking to terrorists, etc. But I would caution a little bit on that, because even though I'm focusing on borders, I mean, the key thing that was very clear in the whole Brexit process and since was how little understood borders are.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm very slow, Will.
No. I mean, it's such a kind of interesting way of kind of coming in at a political problem. You know, let's discuss the border. Let's discuss your attitudes to the border. And let's discuss how you can build trust given contested views about the importance of the border. It's obviously the excellent way of framing Northern Ireland. Mm. But interestingly, kind of, does that travel?
Yes. Even if it does, I would just wonder whether it should quite so much.
But you would say that actually the Irish border, this notion of it being some period in the past in which it was, you know, as hard a border as, I don't know, between East and West Germany, it was actually kind of myth that actually there was always goods and services and culture, people and ideas flowing across this kind of border, and it's more than 200 crossing points.
Yes and no. So obviously it did become heavily securitized. You know, there were obviously close controls, but bridges and roads were blown up and blocked so that people couldn't cross the Irish border. And there was a very real sense of threat and very real threat from the other side of the border. That all happened. And the funny thing was, at the same time as we still had those, you know, military watchtowers and army checkpoints, the UK was part of this EU single market. We saw the Maastricht Treaty, etc., deepen the European Union. So in theory, the movement of goods and other things should have been eased. But we couldn't fully realise the benefits of that on the island of Ireland until we had the peace process and the dismantling of the watchtowers, etc., which the last ones didn't go until 2007.
If you're enjoying our show, you might also enjoy our promotional partners at Inside Briefing, the podcast brought to you by the Institute for Government, the UK's leading impartial think tank dedicated to making government work better. What does Keir Starmer's plan to rewire the state really mean? Can Rachel Reeves balance the books while fixing public services? Could Nigel Farage's Reform Party disrupt devolution? And how will the government handle Donald Trump's unpredictable moves? Hosted by the Institute for Government's director, Hannah White, Inside Briefing brings you expert analysis from the Institute's team, top political journalists and insiders who break down what's happening behind the scenes and share the decisions we made in the corridors of power in Westminster, Whitehall and beyond. So if you want to know how the government really works and why it sometimes doesn't, Inside Briefing is your essential listen. Find it now on Spotify, Apple and all major platforms. From the launch of imperial preference in 1932, right up till joining the then common market in 1973, the British state levied import tariffs averaging 15% on all imports of manufactures into the UK from non-Commonwealth or imperial countries.
Wow.
So there's a border that mattered over 40 years. When I learnt that, I thought, what? You know, I grew up as a young man and behind this tariff. Well, I never knew that. Yeah. I never knew the border was such a kind of thing, but it was. But it didn't discuss. It didn't kind of intrude into our politics. It didn't define our politics. That's what I was trying to say. Mm. There are so many disputes. I mean, we just watched the simmering dispute between India and Pakistan in Kashmir. There's a contested border, if ever there was one. Yeah. Can the techniques and processes that kind of were deployed in the Good Friday Agreement be deployed in Ukraine or be deployed in Kashmir or diffuse tensions between Mexico and the United States, for example?
So,
I see in your face that the answer is no.
I mean, a thing to bear in mind is that, and it's you know, ridiculously obvious thing to say, but it depends on what happens on either side of the border. So you have to have both sides being willing to cooperate and the willingness to recognize the legitimacy of the other as having some say. And of course, that was the thing that made the difference in the case of Northern Ireland, the willingness of the British government to recognize that the Irish government had some right to be heard and to speak on behalf of nationalists in Northern Ireland.
And that's where his model doesn't travel, because in the end, Russia doesn't respect Ukraine's right and India doesn't respect Pakistan's right. You can't get the two sides to actually have a constructive dialogue.
No. And the asymmetry point comes in there too.
Yeah. And huge power imbalances. Yeah.
And that's very true in the case of the UK and Ireland. And again, that's why Brexit was quite so damaging, because it made all of Ireland realise how vulnerable the island is to the whims of the British, if I put it that crudely.
The whims of the British.
Not the British in Northern Ireland. but yeah, that was quite, you know, just sort of realising that actually, because of the border, the Brexit would have a far more immediate and disruptive impact in communities that either didn't vote for Brexit or had no vote in the Brexit referendum. So this was the case of the Irish border community. Those on the southern side, as I say, they didn't have a vote, and yet they were genuinely fearful, and they had cause to fear that Brexit could create terrible disruption to their lives as well.
Are there any really truly open borders? I mean, I suppose within the European Union, you say there were.
Well, it used to be, but what's ironic about the EU is just how easy it has been to suspend its freedom of movement and to have border controls that go far beyond the actual physical border, such as it is. So borders within the EU are much more strong and influential than they have been for a very long time.
I mean, are you, having studied this for so many years, are you an advocate for open borders?
I wouldn't advocate open borders.
You wouldn't?
So borders do exist for a purpose. So we need sort of legal jurisdictions, and you need to have a limit to governance. What I would object to is the use by governments of the border to exacerbate a sense of insecurity within their own territory. That's what we see, is the sense that if you have complaints, basically, if you're feeling some sense of inequality or injustice, the problem comes from outside. So them rather than the us. And shifting blame onto that, which I know puts an awful lot of pressure on border guards, etc., is completely, you know, that's what I would call out. And highlight the fact that, as I say, if you are to manage your borders properly, that discourse doesn't help at all. Instead, what you need is proper means of cooperation and communication with those on the other side.
Very interesting. This kind of vexed question of trust.
Mm.
Is there anything that you've established through your research? What's the kind of three-point plan for trust promotion or whatever? I mean, I'm being slightly facetious, but I mean, if you're advising on building trust to make borders kind of work less onerously, well, what kinds of things would you put your finger on?
Well, uphold the agreements that you signed.
Right, okay.
Just like a first point, just randomly taking that off the shelf. So, yes. So if we're talking about borders here, or something relating to borders, then you'll need two parties here to talk about, at least two signatories to make sure you're interpreting these things the same as well, what you've both committed to. And, yeah, I mean, it's too obvious. But if there's a difficulty, to address that in terms of solving the problem instead of using that as a reason to exacerbate difference, or indeed strengthen your own political position. And that's the challenge with borders, of course, because they are always so easy to provoke a sense of insecurity or indignation. Interesting on trust, again, from this polling that we've been doing in Queens, we've been asking consistently since March 21, when the protocol came into effect, what levels of trust you have in those actors who are responsible. And originally, trust in the British government was 3% when it comes to managing Northern Ireland's interests. Now, this has risen. Our most recent poll, they'll be delighted to see, has risen to 11%. But it contrasts with that of the Irish government in the EU, because, generally speaking, Remain voters trust the Irish government and the European Union, whereas nobody trusted the British government on this. So it's they're going in the right direction. And I think that's partly because, interestingly, they are having to explain the decisions that they're making. They're taking care to do that now. Our Secretary of State for Northern Ireland made a decision to basically overturn a vote taken in the Northern Ireland Assembly on a Windsor framework-related matter. But he explained his reason very well. And I think even though maybe people object to his decision, the fact that they have had it explained why he's making that decision is very significant, I think. And it contrasts so greatly with some of the practices we've had the last few years. So perhaps that's how you begin to increase trust, and perhaps that's being reflected in the polling data. Also interesting, the most trusted actors when it comes to Northern Ireland's interests in the Windsor framework are business representatives.
Oh.
Generally in the public in Northern Ireland, they don't have much say in the public sphere. They're not particularly prominent actors. But I think because they're associated with, do I say telling the truth? I think so. Like just being reasonable about Brexit and the impact of Brexit and, you know, what's in their interest and, you know, practical solutions. That's responded to by people having a strong sense of trust in them, which is welcome at this particular point.
Well, very interesting. I know a great deal more about this than I did before we began. Thank you for coming in, and thank you for setting it all out so clearly. And was there the germs there of a solution?
Trust
building, yeah. I mean, am I looking at a solution bringer?
Well, so I would say don't reify the border. And we need, again, as social scientists as well as policymakers, is to say, what is it that keeps us upholding these particular institutions and processes? And this is I wouldn't say it's a live debate, but it's a pertinent debate in Northern Ireland at the moment. Do we reform the institutions in Stormont? Can we do that to better reflect the contemporary society, which has significantly changed? And a lot of people say, no, you can't. But it's like these sacred cows that I sort of describe as sort of wandering around Stormont, making a mess of the marble corridors. And essentially we should say, why are they there? How do we allow them to be there? And actually, is it time to kick them out and rethink again what Northern Ireland really needs for better policy making?
Now, that's a good note to end on. Let's kick out the sacred cows.
Right.
Professor Hayward, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences in association with the Nuffield Foundation and Leverhulme Trust. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch. And it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. And thank you so much for listening.